There was a radio comedian, humorist named Henry Morgan, who used to say, "Hello, anybody." But I'm more optimistic than he was. I know that you're out there. I know that you're out there, and I'm happy you're there. I am here. I'm Leonard Maltin, and this is Maltin on Movies with Baron Vaughn.
I'm Baron Vaughn, and I know that you might be a bunch of anybodies, but you're definitely not nobodies.
No, no way. Because you're here because you like talking about movies and listening to people talking about movies. A friend of mine, one of my oldest friends, one of the staunchest film buffs I know and a great film teacher.
Oh, staunch? Okay, good.
Once said to me, the only thing better than watching movies is talking about them. And I agree with her.
Sounds like what a staunch person would say.
Yes, yes. Because it is fun to talk about movies. I don't understand people who don't. Who go to the movies and then go home and go,
I mean, I get that. You know, sometimes you want to not think and be like, and then you're done.
Yeah.
But I got to process that stuff, see how it applies to my life.
Me too. So we are taping and record. I say taping, by the way. I'm telling Sam, our engineer, that I'm stuck in the past in so many, many ways. I still use that term, taping.
Well, we are on the reel to reel.
There's no piece of tape anywhere. There's no, there's no physical process here. This is all digits. This is all zeros and ones, right? We're binary. So
we're binarying
a
new episode.
We are, yes.
Well, what was the sentence you were going to say?
We're doing a new episode.
Oh, okay, all right.
today, at the tail end of Black History Month.
Yes.
As we're recording this. It may not be that while you're listening, because you could be listening to this in another universe, in another millennium, for all we know.
Hopefully you get to it before the end of Black History Month, since it is the shortest month. But we're
All the more reason to pack everything into it you can.
Exactly.
Right. So that's what we're going to cover today. We're going to cover three significant, for different reasons, significant films relating to Black history in America. And
slash the Black experience.
Yes. And no, don't slash the Black experience.
No. I'm not going to slash the Black experience.
Okay, fine. So we're going to, there.
Just one of these movies is not specifically about a historical era.
But we're going to have an interesting talk because these films are so diverse.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to start with the best of the lot. We're starting with a film that is monumental.
To say the least.
Yeah. We're speaking of Spike Lee's Malcolm X.
Woo!
From 1992.
Oh, yeah.
I remember when I saw this. I remember where I saw it, in fact. And I remember being blown away. And I also remember how astonished I was that 3 hours and 20 minutes had gone by, and I didn't realize it. And Malcolm X is one of the films I point to when people talk about movies being too long, mm-hmm. you know, and I complain about that a lot. I complain about many movies being too long, but that doesn't mean that a long movie is too long.
Oh, I've seen movies that are 80 minutes that are too long.
Exactly so. Yes, I couldn't agree more. And this is a film that just never loses its grip, never lets you out of its grip, and has interesting stuff coming at you from beginning to end.
It holds you by the shoulders, and then it hugs you, and then it slaps you, and then it shakes you, and then it pats you on the head and says it's going to be all right, and then it punches you, and it's over.
That's right. And how does it open? It opens. You got to get this. It opens. Before you see anything, you hear the voice of Denzel Washington as Malcolm X making the most inflammatory comments.
Incendiary.
Incendiary is exactly the word, because it starts a fire.
It starts a fire.
It starts the American flag.
Boom, American flag on the screen.
And that American flag, this is an image that you don't forget. Mm. The American flag starts burning and burning and burning down to an X. And that, to give credit where credit is due, is the work of the great graphic designer and visual effects guy, Randall Balsmeyer, who often worked with his wife, Mimi Everett, Balsmeyer and Everett. And they have been collaborating with Spike Lee for years and created all of his great main title sequences and a lot of other sequences in his films. And this is one of the most arresting and memorable.
And while that's happening, it's cutting back and forth from the historic footage of Rodney King being helped by a few police officers. Let's say that. Yeah. So he immediately is putting this in the context of the present day, which was happening right when Malcolm X was, this movie was coming out.
Yeah, which is the kind of thing Spike Lee does.
Oh, yeah.
He is, he's, Martin Scorsese calls film directors smugglers, that they smuggle things into movies. And even if perhaps you take on an assignment as a filmmaker, it's not something you feel personally attached to all that much, you can still smuggle a message in. You can smuggle in something that makes it yours and that gives you the satisfaction of having communicated something that is meaningful to you. And Spike takes full advantage of that at every opportunity, no question.
Definitely. It's so much meaning right away. It's this movie is an opera. It's an epic.
Yes, it is. It is epic in every sense of that. And what a story it tells. What a story it tells.
We basically have three parts to it. It's like it's three movies that are just into one, and it always feels like it's never.
Well, how would you?
It's a freight train.
Break it down without revealing too much.
Okay.
For people who maybe haven't seen it. After all, it is a couple of decades old now.
Yeah. See it.
Though it doesn't seem that way.
No, it doesn't. Break it down in terms of which parts of the movies are going on.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the first part of the movie is I call it Malcolm Little, Malcolm, and Malcolm X. Those are the three parts of the movies. Malcolm Little was a criminal, and so we see this first part of his life in Boston, and then also
in the 1940s.
In the 40s in Boston, and then New York, where he's a hustler, like he's just trying to get by, dealing with the circumstances that he has been put in. But you know, he's not a good man. He's not a good person.
He also doesn't have a strong sense of identity.
Not at all.
And in fact, he's berated later on for still straightening his hair.
The old school conk.
Right. In essence, emulating a white man.
Yes, yes.
At least superficially, literally on the surface, emulating a white man. Though he and the character named Shorty, played by Spike Lee, do strut around in their amazing zoot suits.
Multicolored purples and greens and just ridiculous colors.
Yeah.
And huge chains and the gigantic hat with the feather.
Yeah.
Ugh, people did that.
Yeah.
People did that.
Yes. That's a shot I've never forgotten, actually. There's a long, long crane shot, a pullback shot of them. And I think strutting is the only word.
Oh, definitely.
It's strutting toward the camera in bedecked. In their zoot suits.
Bedecked, okay.
And walking under an elevated train.
Yeah.
Under the tracks of an elevated train in the city. And it's supposed to be Boston. And what a shot. What an amazing, amazing moment of film. And
then we also get a little context, because there's every now and then, you know, this movie is very much based on the autobiography of Malcolm X, as told to Alex Haley. And so every now and then we get a little voiceover from Denzel as Malcolm telling a little piece of his story, quotes from the book. So while we're seeing this Malcolm Little story, we kind of flash back a little bit to his childhood, which was unpleasant,
right?
Of course. That would be the first movement, I guess you could say, of the movie.
Yeah.
His climb through these criminal ranks before he ends up in a bad place, jail.
Right. Winds up in prison. And this begins the second phase of the story. Because it's in prison that he meets the man who's going to have the most profound influence on that next chapter in his life by sort of, what would you say, goading him, forcing him to confront who he is and begin to explore who he is. And not only to explore it, but to appreciate his own identity, his own culture, his own history, and to learn to educate himself.
Definitely, this character's named Baines.
He's a fictional character.
Fictional character. There's a lot of artistic license, or license, depending on how you want to pronounce it.
Shocking in a Spike Lee movie.
Yes, yes. But I forgive it because the overall effect is always is just
absolutely
whew.
Yeah.
But Baines, basically, he provokes him and says, "You're so lost." Aren't you? You've no idea who you are. Look what you did to your hair, and look what you did to you. And he also has this way about him that Malcolm responds to, because he seems to be unafraid of the police, of the guards, and he just has this stature and this authority that Malcolm is impressed by.
Yeah. He almost has it's almost Zen-like almost this guy, because this guy is so secure in who he is. That's why he's unafraid, I think, of the mundane things around him. Like, he's not afraid that a prison guard is going to beat him up. And if he does, so what? That's not going to change who he is or his outlook on life. And it makes a deep impression on the character of Malcolm. And, of course, we should add, because we haven't said this yet, that the performance by Denzel Washington and the transition he makes from that street hustler to this sort of lost soul,
who becomes saved.
Right,
who
becomes saved and becomes a seeker of truth and a seeker of solace and knowledge, is an amazing transition to watch. It's a great performance.
I'm shaking my head in agreement of what Leonard's saying, like I'm at church right now, just in case you guys are like, why isn't Barron saying anything? It's because I'm like, yes, yes. And I just don't want to say yes, yes, yes into the microphone.
So now continue with our...
Well, I think it's probably my favorite performance of Denzel Washington's, which is saying a lot.
Yes.
Because the man is accomplished. As I have pointed out, there's an entire other podcast specifically only about him on the Wolf Pulp Network. I tripped on words, so let me just say it like that. But he was nominated. Mm-hmm. I believe he lost to Al Pacino, Son of a Woman, hoo-ha. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that the growth when you see him in prison and shed that exterior of hustler, street pimp, thug, and become a curious, almost childlike man who is like, well, what are things about? And that's the prison years. That would be the second act of the movie.
Yes. And it's one reason that the movie works so well is that you follow this. There's great empathy in following this story and being led along this path with him, alongside him. And especially if you were, like me, ignorant of a lot of this, Malcolm X's backstory, if you will. And so it's enlightening for someone like me in the audience watching. And then he gets out of prison and begins the next phase of his life.
The next phase where he joins the Nation of Islam, which is, by the way, how I first saw this movie. Because I had two friends when I was very young that were young members of the Nation of Islam. And, of course, they wanted to show me this movie when they got it on videotape or whatever. And I sat and watched every moment of it because I was riveted because it's an incredible film.
Right.
I'll say it out loud, I am not a member of the Nation of Islam, but Malcolm X was for a spell, and that's the third part of the movie when he gets out of the prison.
And he falls under the influence of the man himself, played rather amazingly well by Al Freeman Jr.
Great actor.
As Elijah Muhammad. Boy. Boy, oh boy.
And it's just riddled with fantastic performances.
Yeah. Movie. Yes. At every turn.
Great performances. And Elijah Muhammad, what a controversial man.
Yes.
And a figure. He was essentially the prophet of the Nation of Islam.
Right.
And he was the guy that they believed was a new prophet of Allah. And Malcolm became not only his favorite, clearly,
His
favorite preacher, but also the spokesman for the national preacher,
right?
Who he charged with opening mosques, essentially, these mosques around the country, and in to the jealousy of some other people within the organization.
Yeah. And at this point, we're going to start being vague about what happens next, because if you've never seen the movie, or if you haven't seen it in a long time, you may not remember how the rest of the story unfolds, and it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I own this movie. I hadn't seen it for a couple of years. Now, as a person in my 30s, that at least knows a little of what's real in the world, totally different experience. And also as a person in this industry who understands what filmmaking is and how hard it is to actually make anything, I'm also impressed that he pulled that off.
Well, yes, just that the film got made at all. And if you're curious, either before or after watching the movie, I'd recommend after, actually, after you watch this remarkable movie. Then read up on it, because it is a great story and full of interesting
plot twists
and even gossip about how this movie got made. Now, Spike Lee had enjoyed great success, but mostly making smaller scale movies. He'd never tackled anything this ambitious, and it was going to cost a lot of money to make.
Mm-hmm. And people doubted if he could pull it off.
Right. And also, he had to acquire the rights. This movie was essentially 20 years in the making, even before Spike got involved, because there was a producer named Marvin Wirth who first obtained the rights to the book, the Malcolm X autobiography, is told to Alex Haley.
Mm-hmm.
And he made this documentary called The Autobiography About Malcolm X in 1972 with a writer named Arnold Pearl.
Mm.
And so they had done this. They had done the documentary, but they knew that it was ripe for dramatization.
Mm-hmm.
And so for years and years, they tried to make that happen. And they hired James Baldwin,
the legendary,
to write a screenplay, which he did. And all during this time, you know, things nearly happened, didn't happen, almost happened. And then Spike Lee got interested. Oh, no, sorry. I'm leaving out a point. The producer hired Norman Jewison to direct the film. Norman Jewison having made In the Heat of the Night, and he would go on to make A Soldier's Story, which is a terrific movie if you haven't seen that one.
Both of those movies are fantastic.
Yes. And so though Norman Jewison is Canadian and white,
he had actually done movies that he had directed a couple of movies from the black experience.
Yes.
That were actually good.
Yes.
And black people liked them.
Yes.
And that's very important.
Exactly. So he had what we might call street cred.
Mm-hmm.
I would think sufficient street cred to tackle this.
Plus, he had a relationship with Denzel.
Yeah.
Because Denzel was in A Soldier's Story.
That's right. And he would later direct him in Hurricane as well.
Oh, he directed Hurricane.
Yep.
Didn't even know that.
Reuben Hurricane.
Forgot
Carter.
That one.
So he was not just anybody. He was not just some director they picked up. But Spike Lee blew a gasket when he read this and sort of shamed Norma Jewison into backing off. That may be a simplistic way to put what happened, but it seems to me from reading the trades at the time, that's what happened. And he took it on. But then he still had trouble getting the budget he needed to make this long, complex period piece. Period pieces mean money because you got to get, the right wardrobe, the right cars, the
right
locations.
You got to make sure to the locations are, all that stuff.
And this film does all that. It does all of that really well. And it does it at a time before there was CGI to rely on. Nowadays, you can just paint everything in.
Yeah, if there's a building in the shot that says Samsung, you can just get a programmer to erase it.
Couldn't do that in 92. And but he pulled all this off. But at the last minute, the 11th hour, he didn't have the budget he needed. And so he went knocking on a few doors. He went to Oprah Winfrey. He went to Michael Jordan. He went to Bill Cosby. And they're all thanked in the closing credits because they all wrote big fat checks to enable Spike to get this movie done. And that's no small matter. I mean, that's a tremendous show of faith in him and in the subject matter too.
And I think that it paid off.
Yes,
I think so Spike made.
And by the way, it was a hit movie.
Yeah,
very successful movie. So, I think Warner Brothers, which distributed it, once they saw some of the movie and got a sense of how good it was, I think they then fully came on board in terms of backing him and letting him make his movie.
Definitely.
So,
and it is his movie.
Yeah.
Oh,
man.
I love this movie. This is one of my favorite movies of all time, if I haven't said that out loud yet. It really is.
It's, as I say, it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. And it reminds us of things that we need reminding of in terms of what is still fairly recent American history. The conflict between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Malcolm badmouthed him, pretty openly and readily and frequently. Things like that. I mean, it's interesting stuff. There's a lot of food for thought here.
Especially if you guys have just recently seen Selma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That also, I think, does a pretty good job contextualizing current events with what happened in Selma. I think that if you put these two movies next to each other, whew, that's a serious evening.
Yeah. That said, I would also throw in the caveat, which we've mentioned before. Don't believe everything you see in the movies. Don't take any movie as literal fact. Not a smart thing to do. Spike Lee has his point of view. Mm-hmm. Spike Lee has his, we've used the word operatic, but in this case, it's really true. He has this heightened reality that he brings to the factual subject. I mean, there's no mistaking this for a conventional TV movie biopic.
Definitely.
It is anything but that.
It is an art film.
Yeah, it is. It really is. So learn from it, but then if it piques your interest and curiosity, learn more from other factual sources.
Yes.
Instead of a dramatized movie.
Yes, definitely. I co-sign that.
Now, one other point I've got to make, because I went out when this film came out and got the soundtrack CD, and there are two CDs. There's the score by Terrence Blanchard, who has written a lot of great scores for Spike Lee's movies, but there's also the source music CD, which is now, I'm sure, on iTunes, and it is just killer. And there's some scenes.
Source music?
It's got Ella Fitzgerald, The Ink Spots, Billie Holiday. Yeah.
There's a lot of great, yeah.
I mean, it is a parade of beautifully chosen music from the greatest black singers, bands, performers, entertainers of the 20th century. And they're not always the obvious choices. They're not the greatest hits of type of things. And I just love listening to that album, and if you haven't heard it, it's pretty great. Quite apart from the movie,
I haven't heard it, and I'm gonna go get it right now.
Awfully, awfully good. And any film that has the Ink Spots on the soundtrack is okay with me. They turn up with astonishing frequency on soundtracks. And believe me, I'll bring it up again.
Oh yeah,
because it's true.
Please do.
It's true.
Yeah.
I think they sing My Prayer in this film.
Huh. Okay.
Anyhow, in that film that Bill Murray made last year, Hyde Park on Hudson, where he plays FDR.
Oh, yeah, FDR, yeah.
A lot of Ink Spots on that.
Okay.
Soundtrack. Anyway.
It's of the era.
It is. Well, friends, that's Malcolm X, and a great movie by any measure, and well worth seeing, and I can tell you, well worth revisiting, too. Now, when it comes to American history and black American history, one of the notable chapters has got to be the story of the Tuskegee Airmen. So notable, it's been attempted more than once on screen. And in 1995, you may have seen an HBO movie called the Tuskegee Airmen, which had an incredible cast. Lawrence Fishburne, Andre Brower, Malcolm Jamal Warner, Courtney B. Vance, Mekhi Phifer, and Cuba Gooding Jr. That's a great lineup.
Yeah, I saw it.
Mm-hmm. And but another prominent filmmaker had a dream, a genuine dream.
Good choice of words.
I didn't mean to say that. Sorry about that.
That's totally fine.
To tell the story even in a more expansive way.
Mm-hmm. George might know him from a little movie he did.
Well, yes.
Called The Phantom Menace.
Right. Now, George Lucas thinks big.
No.
Yes, he does.
Okay.
Yes, he does. He does,
okay.
Really. He was attracted to the story of the Tuskegee Airmen.
It's a very hard word to say.
Enunciation
time. There's a K, there's a G. They're all next to each other.
Thank you for pointing that out.
No problem.
He was thinking of even doing a trilogy, three films about the Tuskegee Airmen and their experience, because it was called the Tuskegee Experiment originally.
It was a giant, a long project, quote-unquote,
a social experiment.
Yeah.
No less than a social experiment. And it involved recruiting the best and the brightest of young black men in the 1940s. It bringing them to Tuskegee University, giving them a college education, at one point sending them to Africa. And then when World War II was unfolding, recruiting them to start their own squadron, their own air squadron, based in Italy. So, and then there's the aftermath, mm-hmm. the unhappy, this sad aftermath of their great contribution.
It's a very textured story.
Yep.
And very of the time, which was the 40s.
Right. So George Lucas started working on this as early as 1988.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that at all.
It was in the works a long, long time. I think he commissioned several scripts, and it was a question of how to scale his ambitions to a practical reality of what he could actually do. Would it be more than one film? Would it be one feature film? Should it be a miniseries on television? What should it be? And it wound up being a film called Red Tails, which came out in 2012, and which not a lot of people saw.
And the people who did see it
weren't
that big of fans of it.
I'm sorry to say this is our turkey.
Yes.
And I'm sorry to say it because it was made with all good intentions.
In the story of how it got made and why it almost didn't happen is just fascinating and very much shows a lot of how this industry works.
Yeah.
In some disappointing ways and some ways that make sense as well.
He really, you know, this was a subject that was near and dear to him. At a certain point, I think he realized that he shouldn't be the one to make this film. He could fund it, and he did fund it out of his own pocket, mm-hmm. as he does all of his movies. And he could midwife it, you know, shepherd it into existence, but that it ought to be a black screenwriter, and it ought to be a black director. And that's what he did. Ultimately, he hired John Ridley, who came out of television, actually came out of TV sitcoms, but who made quite a splash the year before last writing 12 Years a Slave. He wrote the screenplay that really got made. There had been other writers on it before him. And then he had to leave to work with Spike Lee on a project, and they needed rewrites, and they hired Aaron Magruder from the Boondocks.
Oh, yeah.
Who came in and did rewrites. And the director is Anthony Hemingway, and this was his first shot at directing a feature after a long TV career.
Yeah.
He directed episodes of The Wire, Criminal Minds, CSI New York, Tremé, and most recently he's directing Empire.
So
he's,
yes.
Yeah, so he's had a lot of experience in television, and good television too. And they hired a really good cast, a really talented cast, including Nate Parker.
Nate Parker, who was in The Great Debaters that we spoke of
recently. Tristan Wilde, who I didn't really know, but he plays Junior.
Yeah, he was in The Wire.
Right.
Some of you might know him as Michael.
Right. Elijah Kelly, who plays Joker. Neo.
Who is so sick of love songs. We went to high school together.
Michael B. Jordan.
Michael B.
Who got on a lot of people's radar with Fruitvale Station.
He's going to be the Human Torch in the new Fantastic Four movie as well.
And David Oyelowo.
Yes.
Who is featured pretty prominently in this movie.
Yeah.
And who gives another good performance, playing an American, as he so often does.
His favorite thing.
Though he is a British fellow. And in key supporting roles, Cuba Gooding Jr. and Terrence Howard. We'll talk about them in a minute. Anyway, so you've got a good ensemble here, strong ensemble.
A lot of great actors. Andre Royo as well.
Mm-hmm.
Leslie Odom Jr., who I see a lot around.
Mm-hmm.
But,
well, now, this is a movie that takes place during World War II. And it's about these brave, even cocky flyers. And it's about their superior officers who are fighting to get them recognition and to fight the internal racism within the military hierarchy in Washington that doesn't want Negroes to be given this kind of responsibility. They don't know that they're intelligent enough to fly a plane in the first place.
And Bryan Cranston seems to be the one guy.
Yes, yes.
Who represents all of that.
He does. He's not a subtle role for him. But there it is. And, you know, the problem with this movie is it plays like a very earnest junior high school play.
That's a good way to put it.
You know, it's almost like a film from the 40s, and that's not in a good way. I love films of the 40s. Don't misunderstand. But this is like a B movie from the 40s. It's on that level of writing.
Because the whole time you're watching it, you're like, please, be a movie. I mean, it was 45 minutes into this film where I just felt like it never started. Because I remember thinking, like, I feel like something's going to happen. Like, even though there's air chases.
Lots of dogfights.
There's dogfights with airplanes against Germans. Black people in planes shooting down German-speaking swastikas.
Wait till you see how they depict the Germans. Talk about seeming like a 1940s B-movie. Oh my gosh.
I mean, it's just, I wasn't excited. And I love air chases. But like even there, I was just like, this is somehow not compelling.
Yeah.
And maybe it's because I wasn't into the characters yet. Like, I didn't feel like I knew anyone at any point during this movie.
Yeah.
Which sucks, because I love all of these actors.
Yeah. I guess the best defined character is David Oyelowo, who plays the cockiest of the group, who's really a showboat kind of guy.
Yeah.
Who doesn't listen to orders and does what he feels like doing, takes...
Well, his nickname is Lightning.
Chances, yeah. He takes terrible chances, and often they pay off, but at great risk.
Yeah, he doesn't follow orders, really.
Right.
He follows his heart.
Yeah.
He also falls in love with an Italian woman played by Daniela Rua, who I personally think is gorgeous. She, you might recognize her from NCIS. I think she's on one of those shows. I think it's NCIS Los Angeles, also starring LL Cool J. Let's not get into that. But I do like her. And I just wanted to like this movie so much.
I know. Apparently, George Lucas said around the time of its release that what he wanted was, more than anything, he wanted to give black kids, boys in particular, a movie they could go to and watch black heroes. From recent history,
real
World War II history.
Real heroes.
Real
people
heroes.
Who actually existed.
Yep. And give them that experience in a way that they hadn't had and maybe never had and or very seldom have, which is completely admirable, of course. But somehow when the movie came out, it wasn't positioned as a film for young people. It was just a movie with George Lucas's name on it.
Yeah, they really didn't know how to market it.
No.
And I feel like when it was being made, what I kept hearing a lot about was the marketing. Just like, how are we going to sell this movie?
Yeah, I know.
To any, there's a bunch of black people in it. No one's going to see it, right? So let's just put up a sign and call it a night.
I know.
But also, then it ended up not being a good movie. So many things working against this thing.
Yeah. Now, if you're into visual effects, that would be a reason to watch at least some of this movie, because it turns out it's all one giant visual effect. I'm not kidding. Talk about what you can do with CGI and sound recording now. Almost nothing on camera is real. I think they had a total of three actual planes.
Maybe that's why. Maybe that's another reason. I'm just like, there's no heart in this movie.
I know. It looks like a video game.
Yeah.
Which is something people felt even when Top Gun came out, you know, in the 80s, that it was starting to be a little too much like a video game.
I know exactly what video game was called. Afterburner. I used to play it a lot.
And so in this film, the principals who play these intrepid fighter pilots never went up in the air. In fact, never got into a real plane, never sat in a real cockpit. They were sitting against a green screen in their uniform and their, you know, in World War II, you know,
garb
with a stick in their hand, and everything around them, I mean the cockpit, the the glass in the cockpit.
Wow.
The bird dude that happens to streak against it as they're going a couple hundred miles an hour. All of it was all painted in.
Wow. I had no idea.
And that's how good it is.
Yeah.
That's how convincing it is you have no idea. When they land at the airfield, there's no airfield. There was a little, they had a little plot of land. They built, I think, the hospital. They built a few of the structures at their headquarters. A few structures are genuine, but it goes on for a long distance. There's a lot of planes parked there, all painted in.
So they tried to tell a real story with no real sets.
That's true.
That's
Now, what
incredible.
Is the difference? Now, you're an actor, Baron.
Yes.
Now you've worked in theater,
mm-hmm.
right? A theater actor probably doesn't learn how to do this.
Mm-mm.
Rick McCallum, who is George Lucas's longtime producer, was a guest in my class at USC when we screened this film. And I looked up the transcript of what he said that night. And he was describing what it was like for the actors to shoot those scenes in the cockpit. They're in this primitive mock-up of a set with guys shaking them back and forth.
Mm.
So Rick said, the actor's sitting in this cockpit and he's got a plasma screen in front of him. The director is screaming and a wind machine is coming through. He's being told to move the rudder to the left. There's six or seven grips on each side of the plane. He's got to imagine what it's like to be flying at 500 miles an hour, and it can be brain damage for a lot of people.
Hmm.
That's something they don't teach you in acting school, how to do
that. Yeah, and also probably because it wouldn't really work.
Yeah.
And that's the effect that I feel in this movie, that just nobody felt like they were anywhere at any point, like they were present.
Yeah.
And, I might have said this on the podcast before, an old theater teacher of mine used to yell out a note when he was coaching scenes. He would say, "You guys are in different plays." And sometimes when I see a movie, I go, they're in different movies. And this is a movie where I feel like a lot of really great actors are not in the same movie.
Yeah. Or they are in the same movie and it's not very good.
That too.
Now, how about that pipe of Cuba Goodings, huh?
Oh,
love
that's
that
great.
Pipe.
And it's also just out of nowhere. I'm just like, do we need that?
You know, Cuba Gooding Jr., who I like very much, plays their squadron leader. And he has this big old pipe.
That he uses as like a...
That he uses as a prop.
As a prop, like a psychological, I've got some status, that's why I got this giant pipe. Yeah.
And after a while, all you can look at is that damn pipe.
It's the pipe. It's just like, what? Is there anything in there? Because he never even smokes it, I feel like. He just puts it in his mouth to sit it there.
And then poor Terrence Howard has to deliver all of these earnest and wooden speeches.
I want to say ham-fisted. I love that word.
Yeah, ham-fisted is a good word.
And John Ridley is a really good writer.
Yes, he
is. As well.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man.
Oh, gee, folks. Again, we know what the road to hell is paved with.
Mm-hmm.
And this film is dripping with good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't pay off. And that's too bad.
I'll always love John Ridley for Undercover Brother, so it's okay for me.
Kind of a shame. All right, but we're going to turn it around.
Mm-hmm.
As we try to do every week for you folks, we're going to talk about a sleeper. A movie that both Baron and I like a lot and remember fondly, and we're happy to get to see again because it reaffirmed our good opinion of it. We are here to discuss a sleeper that dates back just over 30 years, my mm-hmm. gosh, called The Brother from Another Planet.
Mm-hmm.
What a good movie. What a good movie. And this was made by the great John Sayles, one of my heroes, truly.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And one of the founders of the American independent film movement.
Definitely.
This is a guy who, first and foremost, he's a brilliantly gifted writer. And he made his name, he won awards writing short stories and novels. And they're all worth reading, by the way. And in the late 70s, he decided he wanted to make a movie. He'd been making a good living writing genre movies for Roger Corman, the king of the B-movies.
Oh.
So he...
Of course.
He wrote Piranha. He wrote The Howling, both of which were directed by Joe Dante.
Oh,
he wrote Battle Beyond the Stars.
Yeah.
Didn't make a good living, but he made a living writing those. And then he built a reputation. And for years after that, and I think it continues at least until recent times, he's made a very good living as an uncredited script polisher. He's the guy they come to at the very end of the trail and say, this script needs punching up. This script needs a little something extra. They'll hire him, pay him well for a couple of weeks' work, and he will improve the script. He did it on Apollo 13, famously, but no credit. But the money he has earned from his Hollywood assignments has enabled him to finance his own personal independent films over 30 years' time. And the first one he made was called Return of the Secaucus 7, a really good movie that people, I think, compare unfavorably, though that's not fair, to The Big Chill, because they're almost the same movie.
Oh, okay.
But I've heard John speak about this, and Return of the Secaucus 7 was made by a very practical guy who said, all right, I want to make a movie. How am I going to do that? Well, it's got to be a contemporary movie. I can't afford to do a period piece.
Right.
I want to use all my friends in the cast. So it's got to be a contemporary movie about people my age. We can't afford to build sets. So we ought to set it in and around like a house, like a big old house that we can get either cheap or for free. He figured all these things out and then wrote the script to suit those needs.
These specific external needs, just things. I don't have this. I don't have that. Okay, yep. What do I have? And that's how indie film works.
Right, and he made his reputation with that film, The Return of the Secaucus 7, and went on to make Liana, Baby, It's You, Matewan, arguably his finest film about coal miners and a labor movement, Eight Men Out, story of the famous Black Sox scandal, City of Hope, Passion Fish, wonderful movie, great performances, Lone Star, another of his best, Men with Guns, Limbo, Sunshine State, Silver City, Honey Dripper, which I like very much, Amigo, and his most recent with the impossible-to-understand title Gopher Sisters. About that more later.
Okay.
He also, being a guy who lived for many years in New Jersey, he became friendly with Bruce Springsteen.
Oh.
You know, Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, very different than the Sphinx.
And directed a number of his music videos.
Oh, okay.
So that's John Sayles. Well,
I'm very ignorant on John Sayles, except for this one particular movie.
Oh, well, there's others that are well worth catching up with. Maybe we'll explore some of the others later down the road. As I say, and he's got a tremendous ear for dialogue. He has many, many skills in his skill set, but one of them is a great ear for dialogue. And I don't think it's possible for him to write bad dialogue. he just knows how people speak.
He knows how people speak, and you can hear it. I mean, the rhythms are very, very particular.
Yeah. And he's got a good eye for talent, too. The person he chose to star in this movie was a young actor, still in the earliest stages of his career, named Joe Morton, who's never stopped working since.
Mm-mm. One of my favorites.
And just won an Emmy last year for his role on Scandal with Kerry Washington. But you've seen him over the years, tons of television work, Law and Order, The Good Wife, you know, a guy who just works all the time because he's so good.
The other time I had seen Joe Morton, besides this movie, the second time I'd seen Joe Morton was The Terminator 2, Judgment Day. He was the guy that invented Skynet, if any of you remember that movie. Yeah, no, most of you were trying to forget, but that was Joe Morton, and that's who is the lead in this movie, The Brother from Another Planet.
Which is about?
A brother from another planet.
A brother from another planet. with the paltriest of visual effects in the opening scene, mostly colored lights.
But so effective.
Yeah, it works.
John Sayles is a perfect example of how much you can do with very little.
That's right. That's right. It's in the writing and it's in the ideas. And then, of course, execution of those ideas, simple as they may be. If you scale your thinking to your abilities, you're home free. And that's what he's managed to do. So this fellow is an alien who somehow, and for reasons we don't know, landed here on Earth. And where? In Manhattan or near Manhattan. Because he actually... He may land in Jersey, actually, because he takes a little, like a boat across the Hudson into
Manhattan Island. Crash landing into the water.
Yeah.
And then he is in a subway station alone.
Anyway, he gets across the water, and you see the Twin Towers. You see the World Trade Center.
You see them a lot.
Yeah.
Because it's New York.
Right.
In the 80s.
And gets into Manhattan, and he doesn't speak. He doesn't speak ever in the movie. But he understands. He understands English.
So every language. He understands Spanish as well.
That's right. That's right. Whatever people say to him, he gets. And the people who are smart that he meets along his interesting path here understand that he gets it. The dumb ones just, they just think he's stupid or a fool. But the smart ones know that he does know what's going on. He has some interesting powers, healing powers in his hands. And he uses them in interesting ways.
Almost E.T.-like. There's a glow, but the way that it works in this movie is, it's artsy. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing I could say. It's very artsy.
And then you find out that he is actually a fugitive from his planet. He's on the lam. And there are two guys clad in black.
And they're billed as the Men in Black. That's their character description.
Long before there was a movie called Men in Black.
Men in Black.
These two guys who are played very straight-faced but amusingly by John Sayles, who does act. By the way, he has a cameo part in Malcolm X.
Does he?
At the end. He's one of the guys, one of the FBI guys recording.
He's the FBI guy. Yeah. Who says a funny thing about Martin Luther King Jr. Yeah, you guys watch that movie and you'll hear it.
Yeah. John's a good actor, too.
Yeah.
He turns up in a number of people's movies, which he says he likes doing because he likes being on other people's sets. He learns about filmmaking from watching other people at work, So which is very interesting. And he sometimes gives himself good roles in his own movies. And here he plays one of the Men in Black. And the other Men in Black is his longtime friend, who was also in Return of the Secaucus 7, David Strathairn. Mm. Wonderful, talented actor, who I almost didn't recognize here. He's so young.
So young, no gray, no facial hair.
No. Skinny.
They wear identical, just all black clothes, but they also both have beauty marks, like black dots on the same side of the cheek in the exact same place, and they move in this very choreographed way, which reads as alien. You're like, okay, these people aren't exactly human, but they look like me. But if I was around them, I'd be like, something's up, which is how everyone feels about them in the movie.
Yes. And so it's the story of this outsider, this alien, trying to just get by. He's just trying to survive. We don't know what his real goal is other than just surviving on the streets of Manhattan. And he meets people along the way. He goes into a bar, meets some people there. Some of them are kind and friendly. Some are hostile. Some are willing to help. Mm-hmm. Some want nothing to do with him. And he meets a wide range of people, and they treat him in various ways. And at this point, the film is somewhat reminiscent of another film that is around that same time, mm-hmm. Being There.
Ah, yes.
Because as people relate to the character of Chance in Being There, by imposing their own ideas on this simpleton, people impose their own ideas and thoughts and meanings on the silence they get back from the brother.
This mute black man.
Yeah.
So everyone just assumes whatever they're about is exactly what he's about. Oh, yes. You're from the South, someone says. Oh, he's from Jersey, like me, someone says. Oh, you're Puerto Rican, like me, someone says. Just he's basically a sponge for everyone else's ideas.
Yes, and it just follows his adventures and misadventures, and some of them are funny, some of them are poignant, you can read whatever you want really into the film as to whether it's a comment on the immigrant experience, what it has to say about race relations, what it has to say about human relations, mm-hmm. just people getting along with each other, people, you know, how people treat each other in life, and regardless of color. And it's also a kind of a time capsule too. You see New York.
Yeah. That's what I was about to say.
Gosh, you see sleazy Times Square with the porn theaters and a newsstand with grimy magazines and newspapers. There's even a National Enquirer headline. I sold my baby to aliens, which was what it used to say on the cover of National Enquirer. And all the sexy images on Times Square, too, about how sex is being used as a come-on to sell things and to sell the tease of or the promise of sex in various ways. It's hard to say much more about this film in terms of story because there's not a lot of story here. It's a series of vignettes and experiences.
There's an emotional logic. It's not like a linear thing as much as this guy's trying to survive, and there are these two men that are after him.
Mm-hmm.
And it pays off in a very beautiful way, I think, in a way, because you watch this movie and you're always surprised.
Yeah.
You never know exactly what's going to happen, but every time you see it, it does make sense. There's still an emotional, like, yes, I get you. Even me yelling at, like, no, don't do that at some point by myself while I was watching this movie. But, it's really beautiful. But I do love that everyone has a code. Mm-hmm. It feels like everyone has a code of conduct, which is why they aid him. Because he, even though he didn't say anything, he was there for them.
Yeah.
So when it comes to the opposite, when they need to be there for them, people kind of come through. There's a little piece of hope in there as well.
Yeah. This film, it's a simple movie. It's not pretentious. It's not ambitious, particularly. It's just original.
It's
original and clever. And I think very engaging.
And I was saying to you earlier, I think that the Coen brothers are influenced very much by not necessarily just this movie, but John Sayles. I mean, I think there's rhythmic things that felt very like, oh man, they must have seen this when they were young and meant like, this is awesome because I feel there's a feeling in this movie that I personally feel like I only ever get out of Coen brothers movies where there's just this unknown kind of delight and pleasure where you watch all these people kind of bump up against each other in ways that you can't expect, but still feel logical.
I agree. And a good cast, too, including a lot of people who, this is a New York-based movie. So in addition to Sayles himself and David Strathairn and Joe Morton, who was doing soap operas and theater work in New York at the time, there's Bill Cobbs, who later became part of John Sayles' sort of on and off stock company. Work with him quite a bit. Caroline Aaron plays the woman who takes the brother in to her apartment.
She was in Primary Colors, which we just spoke of
That's
recently.
Right. There's a nightclub singer played by Dee Dee Bridgewater, who was a wonderful singer, a great jazz singer that still to this day. Rosetta Lenoir.
That's my personal favorite cameo. Some of you might remember a show called Family Matters. Remember the mom, the grandma? That's what we're talking about. And when you see her, you'll be like, what? Yes.
And John Sayles' producing partner and longtime companion, Maggie Renzi, who's in almost all his films, plays the social worker in The Office. She's always good. And Fisher Stevens, a very young Fisher Stevens, shows up in a scene on the subway doing a card trick
incredibly young Fisher Stevens.
Yes, very, very, very
young. He didn't have a robot with him.
Nope. Not one in sight. So if you're in the mood for something offbeat and modest, short, that'll, I think, put a smile on your face.
It looks great and it feels great.
Shot by Ernest Dickerson.
Ernest Dickerson, who was also the director of photography on Malcolm X.
And many of Spike Lee's earliest films.
And you might also know him from a movie called Juice. That's from a black people.
Talented cinematographer.
Yes.
And working here on a very low budget, obviously, but doing a nice job. As I say, you would do yourself a favor to try out The Brother from Another Planet.
And you're in luck. It's on Netflix.
Yes.
Right now.
And I would like to pursue with you the idea of seeing some other John Sayles films.
Okay. Definitely.
Because there are a lot of good ones.
I've seen Lone Star.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was another one that you said that I had seen. Oh, Passion Fish. I've seen mm-hmm. Passion Fish as well, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think Lone Star may be his biggest box office success. I mean, that was closest to a mainstream success that he had over the years. Mm. And his latest film, I just have to go off on this tangent.
Okay.
His latest film, very small, another very, very small film called Gopher Sisters. And he came to my class at USC with it. And we're very happy to have him. And he came with Edward James Olmos, who's in it. And again, he's still financing his films, you know, and they're, you know, they're so it's so tough to get any movie made. The fact that a movie comes out at all is miraculous.
Especially now.
And he does a lot of his recent films. He's even done his own releasing.
Oh.
I mean, talk about DIY filmmaking.
Which Spike Lee, I think, is doing right now as well.
But the title, it's like, what does that title mean?
Yeah, how's it spelled?
Go for sisters.
Well, F-O-R or F-O-U-R?
F-O-R.
Okay.
Well, what it means is that it's about a woman and a girlhood friend of hers. They meet up after many, many years' time. And at one point, they start reminiscing. And people said they looked so much alike they could go for sisters.
Okay.
And it's like, that is not a good movie title. You know, you're already working with two strikes against you with a low budget film that's not going to have any advertising budget, that doesn't have stars in it, that doesn't have special effects or any of those things that are considered, you know, box office fodder. Don't saddle yourself with a title that is impenetrable.
Yeah, the only thing I could think of was Gopher, which sometimes is a nickname that gets tossed to PAs and production assistants because they go for this, they go for that. So sometimes they get called Gophers. And I thought maybe it was a reference to that, but not at all.
No,
because even that reference is inside baseball.
Uh-huh.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, you know, Brother from Another Planet is fantastic.
Yes, it is.
Great title as well.
And he continues to be a great talent that I admire tremendously. So we'll return to John Sayles.
All right.
And we'll return to talk to you about three more movies the next time we meet here. In what world is this? This is the world of...
Wolf Pop.
The world of Wolf Pop. That's exactly what
we're... The wonderful world of Wolf Pop.
Yes.
And we just need Tinkerbell to kind of do it. The castle of Wolf Pop, and she does the thing.
That would be nice. Mm. You should suggest that as a logo.
I think we'll get
an
sued.
Animator in.
We'll definitely get sued. By Disney, nonetheless. I don't want to mess with their lawyers.
Hey, if you're going to get sued by somebody.
Get sued by the best.
Yeah. As for the podcast, we are, of course, on iTunes. We're on SoundCloud.
Yeah. And also the Wolf Pop website.
Of course, the Wolf Pop home site, where you can look up all the previous episodes, find amazing candid photographs taken during the production of our show, which is a colorful affair, and let me assure you of that. We would invite you to rate us on iTunes, review us.
Tell your friends.
Especially if you like us.
Yes, especially if you like us. That'll help. That'll help, is all I'm saying.
Yes, because we want to keep this going. You can donate. You can tell more friends. You can buy an episode as a gift for your pals. Any number of options.
Yeah, if you guys just want to send me 2 cents. And when I say that, I don't mean your opinions. No, I'm joking.
Anyway, we're happy to have you there. We will see you next time.
Pop.
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 Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.